There's lots of speculation and some nail-biting among NBA fans about the fate of Cleveland Cavaliers megastar LeBron James. Sports commentator Frank DeFord has a few thoughts.
Basketball is surely the only major team sport where the great player is faced with such a paradox, that the more he exhibits his greatness, his ego, the more he is likely to diminish the rest of his team and lose. Rarely in other sports are the lasting reputations of great players scarred if they were not on a championship team. But after seven seasons without winning with the Cleveland Cavaliers, LeBron James is even sometimes put down as some glamorous matinee idol who hasn't the grit to close the deal. Never mind that his Cavalier teammates have often only been a collection of little more than snips and snails and puppy dog tails. In fact, NBA history is rife with examples of heroes who could not carry their teams to victory until they were paired with a companion star. Bob Cousy could not win until Bill Russell joined him. Oscar Robertson needed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Julius Erving, Moses Malone, and yes, even Michael Jordan, who was celebrated as the most passionate winner ever, could not will his way to a title until Scottie Pippen evolved into his loyal Tonto. This is especially important now as LeBron James officially becomes a free agent tonight. The instant July begins. No day has been so anxiously awaited in New York and other NBA cities since 1933, when Prohibition was repealed. But the Knicks, in particular, are so woebegone that the thinking is that they can't possibly attract King James without also signing another free agent royal like Chris Bosh, who is likewise being set free, he from Toronto. Ironically, despite the league's salary cap provisions, there are two ways that James could legally manipulate the strictures. First, and because he makes so much endorsement income away from the court, if he really wants a star sidekick to help him win a title, James could be like those plutocrats who take a dollar a year in token remuneration for some civic job. He could selflessly accept the NBA minimum allowed and thus free up a huge sum for a running mate. Or as was first suggested by Forbes, because Madison Square Garden is a publicly traded company, if James wants to play in New York, he could buy shares in MSG, then sign with the Knicks and cash in when the stock rose on the announcement. Crane's New York Business estimates that the franchise's value could increase by as much as $150 million if James signs with the Knicks, even more if they can add an extra star and actually start winning. It's certainly fair to say that never has any athlete been such a valuable financial commodity, and neither has any athlete ever been in such a position to, in effect, buy his own championship. Superstars often say they'd give anything to win. Well, James could. All he has to do is sell himself short.
Sports commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday for member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. To bolster cleanup efforts in the Gulf, the U.S. has accepted help from a dozen nations and international groups, according to the State Department. That includes two high-speed skimmers that are on the way from Japan. Those already working in the Gulf are facing a new problem, though, by the name of Hurricane Alex. It's not headed for Louisiana, but the choppy waters have forced the Coast Guard to dock skimmers and other boats. That means more oil is reaching shores that had been mostly cleaned. NPR's Jeff Brady spent yesterday with crews on the beach in Port Fouchon, Louisiana.
Crews along this beach are very busy filling plastic bags with sand and rocks covered with reddish-brown oil. Workers only have to look out at the menacing waves to know why the crude is washing up now.
The waves are 10 to 15 feet high when they break, and not somewhere where you'd want to be swimming right now.
U.S. Coast Guard Ensign Cameron Cooper says normally the water here is calm. Waves are only a foot or so high, but the storm has changed everything. It had been more than 2 weeks since any oil had washed up on this beach. The crews were just finishing when the storm started moving their way.
Unfortunately, the timing of it wasn't ideal because the oil was right at our doorstep right when all these waves came too, so those two factors together make it a mess right now.
Nearby, Jerome Benjamin of New Orleans is slipping into a yellow hazardous material suit. He's among the temporary workers hired to clean up these beaches.
Simple stuff, you know, just cleaning up. It's not as hard, you know, but quick as we get it up, quick as they come.
It sounds kind of frustrating, the idea of, like, you just clean it up and then more oil comes in.
No, not really, because that means the more oil come in, the longer we stay out here, more work.
Were you looking for work when this came along?
Yes, I was. Yes. It is a blessing.
It doesn't take long for workers to fill up another dumpster with oil trash, sand, and rocks. Ensign Cameron Cooper predicts it'll take another week just to clean up all the damage caused in the last couple of days.
Eventually we'll win and we'll have our beach back.
But there's no guarantee the beach will stay clean. There are still millions of gallons of oil out there floating around, and no one yet knows where it'll all end up. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Port Fourchon, Louisiana.
When CNN's Larry King announced last night that he would retire, it solved one headache for the struggling cable news giant, but it created another. NPR's David Folkenflik offers his take on the stakes for CNN.
CNN executives say in spite of declining ratings for King and for the whole network, they're making plenty of money. But the chess pieces sure have been moving about the board with alacrity. Lou Dobbs left last fall, Campbell Brown last month, and now Larry King. That had been CNN's entire lineup from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Jonathan Klein is the president of CNN's American Network. He says King's replacement should
be intelligent, it be informed, it be surprising. The best interviews take you places that you never knew existed with people you thought you knew, but it turns out you didn't.
Campbell Brown was relatively new to CNN, but asked to get out of her contract, saying she couldn't win against the opinion-driven shows of Keith Olbermann on MSNBC and Bill O'Reilly on Fox News. Political anchor John King hasn't been a big ratings winning either in replacing the bombastic Lou Dobbs.
You don't want to just sit here and do on one hand and on the other hand, which seems to be kind of the game that CNN is doing right now. And it feels, frankly, a little tired.
Steve Kappas is president of NBC News, and in that role, he oversees cable news rival MSNBC. The runaway ratings leader, of course, is Fox News, with its largely conservative primetime shows. But MSNBC's embrace of political talk by day and a left-leaning primetime lineup has paid off. Steve Kappas.
All day long now, audiences are coming to MSNBC that used to go elsewhere. They used to go to CNN. This is one of the busiest news cycles we've ever seen. And MSNBC, day in and day out, is winning.
When Lou Dobbs left CNN, it seemed to clarify the network's position, reporting over opinion. Now, CNN's John Klein puts it slightly differently.
What we will always strive to be known for is real reporting, incisive analysis, and informed opinion.
At 8 p.m., CNN is pairing the disgraced former New York Governor Elliot Spitzer, a liberal crusader, with the conservative Pulitzer-winning columnist Kathleen Parker. It's an echo of the political debate show Crossfire, a show Klein killed 5 years ago. This time, he promises, the effect will be different. But now, Klein has to fill the 9 p.m. slot, too. More pieces to chase about the board. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR. Let's get back now to a subject we're considering this week, the criminal brain. This morning, we're going to hear how neuroscience has entered the courtroom as neurolaw. And some scientists and legal philosophers say the law should give psychopaths a break because their brains may function differently from most people's. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty explores now the brain of a serial killer.
Kent Keel has studied hundreds of psychopaths. Keel is one of the world's leading investigators of psychopathy and a professor at the University of New Mexico. He uses a scale called the Hare Psychopathy Checklist to measure traits such as the inability to feel empathy or remorse, pathological lying, or impulsivity.
The scores range from 0 to 40. The average person in the community, a male, will score about 4 or 5. Your average inmate might score about 22. Brian scored like 38.5, basically. He was in the 99th percentile.
Brian is Brian Dugan, a man who is serving 2 life sentences for murder in Chicago. Last July, Dugan pleaded guilty to raping and murdering 10-year-old Janine Nicarico in 1983, and he was put on trial to determine whether he should be executed. Keel was hired by the defense as an expert witness. In a videotaped interview with Keel, Dugan describes how he only meant to rob the Nicarico's home, but then he saw the little girl inside.
She came to the door and I clicked.
Okay.
Turned into Mr. Hyde and Dr. Jekyll. I couldn't stop.
Notice the flatness of Dugan's voice. That's typical of a psychopath. And note how he describes his emotions.
And I have empathy too, but it's like it just stops. I mean, I start to feel, but it just, something just blocks it.
Kent Keel says he's heard that before. All psychopaths claim they feel terrible about their crimes.
But then you ask him, what does that mean? You feel really bad. And Brian will look at you and go, what do you mean? What does it mean? You know, they look at you like, can you give me some help? You know, hint? Can I call a friend? You know, they have no way of really getting at that at all.
And Keel says the reason they can't get to their emotions is because their physical brains are different. The gate at the Juvenile Detention Center in Albuquerque, New Mexico, swings open and a huge trailer drives through. This is Keel's $2 million mobile MRI that he takes to maximum security prisons. He's scanned the brains of more than 1,100 inmates, about 20% of whom are psychopaths. For ethical reasons, Keel can't let me watch an inmate in the MRI, so he asks his researchers to demonstrate.
All right, Gab, you see the word ready on the screen?
All
right, for this first task, you're going to see pictures of people and events presented one at a time.
In this test, the subject sees 3 types of pictures. One has no emotional or moral content. For example, students standing around a Bunsen burner. Another type is emotional but morally ambiguous, a car on fire, but you don't know why. And the third depicts a moral violation.
There's a picture of someone about to, looks like it might shoot a child. And so that might be rated as rather high moral content.
And the subject does rate it as morally objectionable. Keel says most psychopaths say that pictures like this are a moral violation, but there is a key difference. When a normal person sees this photo, the limbic system lights up. Keel calls that the emotional circuit. It involves the orbital cortex above the eyes and the amygdala deep inside the brain. But when Brian Dugan and other psychopaths see the same photo, Keel says, the emotional circuit does not engage in the same way.
We have a lot of data that shows that psychopaths do tend to process this information differently. And Brian looked like he was processing it like the other individuals we've studied with psychopathy.
Keel says the emotional circuit may be what stops us from breaking into that house or killing that girl. But in psychopaths like Dugan, the brakes don't work. Keel says psychopaths are a little like people with a very low IQ, who are not fully responsible for their actions. The courts treat people with low IQ differently. For example, they can't get the death penalty.
Well, what if I told you that a psychopath has an emotional IQ that's like a 5-year-old? Well, if that was the case, then would we make the same argument for individuals with low emotional IQ, that maybe they're not as deserving of punishment or not as deserving as culpability, etc.?
It's a controversial argument, but a number of prominent scientists and legal scholars at places like Harvard and Princeton agree. And that's exactly what Brian Dugan's lawyers argued at trial last November. Attorney Steven Greenberg said that Dugan was not criminally insane. He knew right from wrong, but he was incapable of making the right choices.
Someone shouldn't be executed for a condition that they were born with, because it's not their fault. The crime is their fault, and he wasn't saying it wasn't his fault, and he wasn't saying give him a free pass, but he was saying, don't kill me because it's not my fault that I was born this way.
This argument troubles Stephen Erickson, a forensic psychologist and legal scholar at Widener University. He notes that alcoholics have brain abnormalities. Do we give them a pass if they kill someone while driving drunk?
What about folks who suffer from depression? They have brain abnormalities too. Should they be entitled to excuse under the law? I think the key idea here is that the law is not interested in brain abnormalities. The law is interested in whether or not someone at the time that the criminal act occurred understood the difference between right and wrong.
At trial, Jonathan Brody, a psychiatrist at NYU Medical School who was the prosecution's expert witness, went further. Even if Dugan's brain is abnormal, he testified, the brain does not dictate behavior.
There may be many, many people who also have psychopathic tendencies and have similar scans who don't do antisocial behavior.
Who don't rape and kill.
Who don't rape and kill.
And he told the jury, Dugan's brain scan in 2009 says nothing about what his brain was like when he killed Janine Nicarico.
I don't know with Brian Dugan what was going on in his brain, and I certainly don't know from a brain scan that was taken 24 years later what was going on then.
The jury seemed to zero in on the science, asking to reread all the neurological testimony during 10 hours of deliberation. But
breaking news now, jurors have decided the fate of convicted murderer Brian Dugan. He has been sentenced to death for the
ultimately, jurors said, the horrific nature of the murder earned Dugan the death penalty. Dugan is appealing the sentence. In the meantime, this case signals the beginning of a revolution in the courtroom, says Kent Keel. Just like DNA, he believes that brain scans will eventually be standard fare, and that, he and others say, could upend our notions of culpability, crime, and punishment.
Neuroscience and neuroimaging is going to change the whole philosophy about how we punish and how we decide who to incapacitate and how we decide how to deal with people.
And neuroscience may have already played a pivotal role in a Tennessee murder case. Tomorrow, the warrior gene goes on trial. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
And you can hear the first story in our series on the criminal brain at our website, npr.org.